The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
As promised, and it's time for our hour of medical virology and science with Dr. Henry Nyman, who is here once a month. And so far, the flu season isn't bad. In fact, it isn't much of anything, which is good, except there are a few things that need to be discussed here, and Henry has offered to stop in and bring us all up to speed there. Hello, Henry. Happy holidays. How are you?
Hi, Jeff. Same to you. Not too bad.
Good. Good.
It seems like a good opportunity to kind of discuss a couple of these areas that you had mentioned. Because it is flu season. It actually could end up being a fairly severe flu season for humans. It's a little bit early, but there's some evidence that the vaccine might not work as well as anticipated, and that really had to do with how the vaccine is made and that the virus is grown in eggs, and that led to selection of a change in the virus, a glycosylation site. So the virus actually that's in the vaccine, it really kind of covers up an important area that the immune system doesn't recognize, because it's got this sugar coating, if you will. And as a result, the virus in circulation, is transmitted in humans, which are mammals, and they don't have the glycosylation site. The target is there, but it's not really, the antibodies to it really aren't present in the people that are vaccinated.
Did you not tell me last time this was a quadrivalent? Am I remembering right?
Well, there is a quadrivalent. Now, interestingly enough, the difference is that there's really kind of three different versions that are out there. There's a quadrivalent, and in that case, they take both versions of influenza B, in part because they used to keep getting it wrong, that it would kind of flip-flop.
Right.
There's two major versions, and it would flip-flop.
And they guess, and they'd be off
each year. They'd make the vaccine from last year, and then the other one would take over the following year, and so the vaccine would be wrong. And, it wasn't that they were right half of the time. It was right. They weren't right at all. And, they were getting close to zero. That they had switched it every year, and the virus would switch every year. And that would be a mismatch. So they kind of gave up on guessing, and they created a quadrivalent, which has got both versions of influenza B, and then they've got two versions of influenza A. They got H1N1 and H3N2. And then there's for seniors, they have another version that is essentially twice the concentration, so they give more virus to help seniors who've got kind of a...
So they have to really force a bigger immune response in seniors?
Well, they're trying to get one. I mean, the older you get, the weaker your response is. And so the idea is they give you more virus so that you'll mount a decent response and have some antibodies to ward off the actual virus.
Is this attenuated, Henry, or is this a dead virus?
These are dead viruses. These are viruses that are given by shot. The other version is actually is actually the trivalent vaccine. So in all cases, the virus is basically the H and the N are reassorted with a standard virus that was actually isolated in Puerto Rico back in the 1930s. And they use that one as the backbone, and the H and the N get tagged onto it, and then they grow up the virus, and then they kill the virus, and then there's that killed virus that's used for the shots. The attenuated virus is in the live vaccine, which is a nasal spray, and they ran into some problems with the nasal spray, and I'm not even sure that the nasal spray is currently available. They were having issues that it wasn't generating as good an immune response. It's more popular with children because children don't like needles, and so they do the nasal spray. But the nasal spray ran
so it's it may be even gone. Interesting. I haven't heard about it for a while.
Yeah, so I'm not even sure if that's available. Now, one interesting aside is I went to get the flu shot, I think I went to CVS, and I figured, well, I might as well ask, since I knew there was this problem with the virus growing on eggs. And I said, oh, do you have a vaccine that was actually grown on mammalian cells? And to my surprise, they said yes, that they basically have they have a version that is grown on mammalian cells because some people that come in for the shot have egg allergies, and you know there's a problem with the virus grown in eggs because when they purify the virus, there's a potential for some of the components of the egg to kind of get mixed in when they do the isolation, and to avoid that, they there is one company that does grow the virus on mammalian cells, and that was available. I said, you want the quadrivalent, you want the high dose, you want the regular dose, and I said, I'll take the mammalian one, and there it was. They gave it to me, and I don't have the flu yet, but the sample size is one, and it is early the flu season. But it is available, and I'm kind of surprised that more haven't talked about actually getting the virus grown in mammalian cells to avoid the issue of people like oscillation.
As opposed to chicken.
The virus embryo. Is grown in eggs. All the other ones are grown in, they're pathogen-free eggs, and pharmaceuticals are used to using that, and they've got all the equipment to do that. So they have these, rooms with lots and lots of chicken eggs, and they go and they inject the virus into the eggs, and that's where the virus grows, and then they basically crack open the eggs or suck it out. I'm not even sure how they harvest it from the eggs, but anyway, that's how it's done with most pharmaceuticals.
Another question: we go into these stores like the one you mentioned. We don't have that out here, but whatever, the same kind of store.
Yeah,
Walgreens, whatever.
Yeah. Right.
You go in there and you see
flu shots.
Yeah, you see flu shots here, and there's some smiley face or something. Do you know what you're getting? No one asks. It's going, I'll take one, and you get it. Should you be doing a little more due diligence before you do that?
Well, Well, they, like I say, when I went there, they had a choice of like four different vaccines, you know, that.
Well, you know what you're doing, though. The average person doesn't know.
Right, right. And you know, they basically kind of divide it up on the person. You know, if you come in and you're over 65, they'll say, well, you should really take the high dose. And if you're under 65, they'll probably just give you the trivalent. I'm not even sure what the default is. I don't think it's the trivalent or the quadrivalent.
Mm-hmm.
But, they've got them all sitting there in the refrigerator. And if you ask, you can kind of pick and choose. So there are more choices today than there have been in the past. And I think that most of the time you go in and they give you the one that they have that matches.
Yeah.
For the most part, it's probably just based on age. That if you're older, they'll say, we've got this, and I don't remember the name of
so,
it, but you know, each one has a commercial name. And I say, well, we have this. It's recommended for over 65. And
so one's called middle age.
People normally get if that's their age. If they're younger, they'd probably get the trivalent.
All right. Now, it's always amused me, these cutoff dates. So you're 64 and 11 twelfths, and you get the trivalent, and you add another few weeks, and you're 65, and they give you the mega dose, so to speak. It just seems odd to me.
Well, they give you the choice, and you can kind of pick and choose. And like I say, if you want the quadrivalent, that's the quadrivalent. I don't think is in the higher dose. I think it's the trivalent. So if you go in there and say, well, you know, I'd rather have four than three, and I'd rather take the standard dose rather than the high dose, then you can go and ask for that. And they're all essentially the same, you know, that over 65, Medicare pretty much covers the whole cost. I mean, it doesn't cost anything. And most insurance companies do cover the flu shot. So sometimes if you go into the pharmacy, I don't know how it is nowadays. I know in the past, sometimes you paid and then you got reimbursed by your insurance. And other times you paid like $5 or something and they built the insurance for the balance. And over 65, it doesn't cost anything. As long as you got a Medicare card. And so that's kind of, you know, how it works. And that was kind of a little aside. I was,
that's good information.
I was surprised that they actually had the mail-in version. I think if there was a rush and everybody asked for it, it'd probably be a problem because it's not like that's the main thing that they have stocked. But I think there was a problem. They had mentioned that they had gotten a fair amount of it because something was going on with the other one. I don't know if there were production issues or something, but they were low in stock, and they got more of the mammalian one, and they happened to have a fair
this
amount
leads,
when I was there, although I just took one. But
this leads to the obvious question, what kind of mammalian cells are these?
Oh, they're
fetal?
I think they're the standard MDCK. I think these are dog kidney cells that are pretty standard for growing viruses, and
all
these
right.
were established quite some time ago. You know, probably in the 60s or so. So there are a few standard lines that you know, labs use for growing viruses, and the mammalian ones, I think they're probably a version of that. For some reason, kidney cells seem to do well in tissue culture, and these were canine dog kidney. And like I say, I don't know the exact date. The MDs stands for the two scientists, Marin Douglas or something. I don't know. Everybody just uses the initial. So it's MDCK, and in all likelihood, it's that or most of the time they would be cell lines established either from animals or, and there might be some human ones, but those were usually those are from, tumor extracts. It's basically
tumor extracts.
That's where the cell line came from.
That famous cancer woman.
Basically,
what's her name? I can't remember. You know who I mean. The woman they named that cancer line after her.
Right,
cell line.
HeLa cells.
That's it.
I don't know. The names come a couple different ways. One was Helen Lane, and Lax, I think. I remember the first name.
I remember it was LACKS or something like that, wasn't it?
Right. So the name of the cell line is HeLa, H-E-L-A.
Yeah.
And it's the H-E is for Helen
and Lax, L-A.
Lax, L-A. Yeah. Some had said it was Helen Lane, but anyway, I think Lax is the right name, but HeLa is the abbreviation, regardless of what.
Now, do you actually get, Henry, with, let's say you get a dog kidney line, a mammalian line, or even HeLa.
Right.
Do you actually get human cells mixed in with the viral agent itself in this vaccine? Are you receiving any cells?
Well, the way these cells work, these are fibroblasts, and their cells have basically adhere to the glass, but technically it's plastic. So they're grown in these plastic flasks, and the cells basically stick to the bottom of the flask, and they get infected, and then the virus grows in the cells, and then they bud from the cells, and they're in the fluid above the cells, and to isolate the virus, you basically take the fluid, so almost all the cells are left behind on the plastic, but there would be some floating cells there, and there would be some pieces of cells, and so you basically rely upon centrifugation and how big the pieces are as to how fast they would go to the bottom of two in a centrifuge, and so you basically can clear that out. You can spin it at a kind of a low speed, and everything that's big will go down to the bottom. So you'll take whole cells and pieces of cells, and they'll pellet down to the bottom of the centrifuge tube, and the virus will be floating in the liquid above that. And then kind of depends on what scale you're working on, but you can then purify the virus from that liquid spinning it at an ultra high speed through a sucrose gradient, and you go and you make a gradient of sugar, if you will, and when you spin the virus hard, it'll float down through that gradient until it gets to the same density in the sugar gradient that the virus is, and it'll band there. And so you can clean these things up, pretty well. And then you can also do filtration methods where you have filters of a given size, and the virus can go through the filter, and the larger cells or debris can't. And so you basically force the virus through the filter, and the virus goes through, and the liquid that comes through and all the cell debris stays on top. So there are various techniques that are used in the lab to kind of separate the virus from everything else and get a fairly purified product. Even though they at one point were in a mammalian cell or were in a chicken egg, if you will, and the idea is that what's actually used in the vaccine is pretty much a pure virus, and you know, I think for the egg allergies, you aren't really getting, you know, egg cells. You're probably getting something in the egg, you know, some egg protein. Mm-hmm. And so in those cases, you know, if you're looking at a protein, you could conceivably have some protein, which would be much smaller than a cell or a cell debris.
Right.
And that would be more, you know, in the range of
talking down to microns.
Techniques. So, right. So there are various techniques to go ahead and clean these things up. And you know, cell lines that are used to make viruses for vaccines, et cetera, you know, are basically tested to make sure they don't have any pathogens and they're grown under, you know, carefully controlled conditions so
right,
they don't
right.
get contamination,
well,
et cetera. So,
right.
so there are a lot of precautions. I mean, even with the eggs, the eggs actually have to come from chickens that are pathogen-free, certified. You know, all these things go through, you know, a lot of testing to make sure that the product that actually goes into the vaccine is pretty much just the virus, or in the case of the
vaccine, one would hope so.
A reassorted virus, which has just got the H in the N. So, I mean, the virus is actually killed isn't even the virus is that is the source of the two targets, which is the H and the N. They are actually H and N genes that are on a background of this PR8 cell, or not cell line virus that has the other six proteins. But that's getting a little off the topic of what we're going to kind of cover today.
We got just a minute. Hold on. We got a minute till the break, so that we'll take our break, then we'll come back and get into the topic du jour. The last question I had, obviously, would go back to the disaster of SV40. That was a tough one. People beyond that, though, Henry, people now, a lot of them are aware that some of the components in a vaccine, like thimerosal, mercury, not pretty advantageous for the human body, all in all. How many adjuvants and other extras are in these flu vaccines? Do you know?
Yeah, there aren't any. The flu vaccines are pretty clean. They just take the virus. They basically, in the U.S. anyway, there's some European versions where they actually do add some adjuvants to the vaccine to make them more immunogenic. But in the United States, the flu vaccine.
So it's about as clean and pure a vax as you're going to get.
Just a killed virus that's got an H and an N circulating and a standard six other genes that have been used in vaccines since the 1930s. Well, the virus was isolated in the 1930s. I don't know, might not have gotten into vaccines till the 40s, but, you know, a good over a half a decade of experience with the carrier virus.
Very good. All right. Dr. Henry and I will be right back in just a couple minutes. Dr. Nyman's website is up there, and he, of course, has been a regular on this program for, 40 years, Henry?
Oh, it's been a while.
Seems like it.
actually, some of the history I was going to cover today, we'll go back to those early days.
The early days.
Remind how things have changed.
Very good.
You know, like a little over a decade.
Very good.
Not that early.
Okay. We'll be right back with Henry Nyman in just a minute. Hang on. Okay, welcome back. And all right, Henry, go ahead. Let's take a look over our shoulder here and see what you've got.
Okay, the two things I wanted to kind of focus on tonight, which I haven't really touched on yet, were both the spread of H5 by wild birds. It's a new season, and there actually is a new virus. And then touch a little bit on the H7N9 in China, which kind of a new version that first appeared at the beginning of 2017, end of 2016, the beginning of 2017, which was the high pass version of H7N9. Recently, quite a few sequences were released showing that high pass virus has spread pretty dramatically in China, both in poultry as well as in humans. And there's several different versions of that are circulating in addition to the low pass. And that creates some problems because each version has some characteristic changes that have to do with adaptation to humans or increased virulence. And there's a concern that the low pass and high pass will kind of reassort or recombine to create a virus that's got some of the bad components of each and make it more easily transmitted in humans and potentially even more deadly. But I want to start with a new virus reports came out about a month ago. Sequences just came out in the last week or two. And I've said many times on your show the stories of the sequence. And the news and media reports on these, most of the sources are fairly sequence challenged, and the stories really leave out the key issues with respect to what is in the sequence and what that sequence tells you about where it came from and where it's going. And so the new and improved virus this season in the wild birds is H5N6. The H5N6 actually, to some of your listeners, may not sound that new, that H5N6, has caused some problems in China in the past several years, including the ability to infect humans. And so the H5N6 that has infected humans in the past is a concern because the H5 is the Fujian strain, which was initially identified in Fujian province as H5N1, and that H5 part has gone through reassortments with various ends, giving rise to a whole series of different serotypes, including H5N6. The H5N6 that causes problems in humans is really an Asian virus, and the N6 is really from birds that have been found largely in Asia. But the H5N6 that's in the news today actually doesn't have that Asian N6. That actually has an N6 that's found in some Asian places, but it's also found in Europe. And that is where this H5N6 was first reported, kind of at the end of last season in March of 2017, and that was identified in Greece. And like I said, it was the end of the season. That was kind of the end of the reporting on that, and then the virus is just been reported recently in both Taiwan and Japan, and those sequences, the Japan sequence was in a wild bird of Yichuan in Jimei province, and that was isolated in November, and that sequence was just released. And what the sequence shows is that the N6 was circulating in wild birds in Europe, and the other 7 gene segments all match the H5N8. And the H5N8, again, was another Fujian virus, which really started to cause headlines several years ago when it was kind of in a few European countries, and it was in Japan and South Korea. And then it created devastation when it moved into both Taiwan as well as North America. And if you recall, in Taiwan, it kind of came in as H5N8, and then a couple other versions, H5N2 and H5N3, were identified. They all had the same H5, but they had picked up different ends from wild birds in Asia. And that virus was slightly different than the one that was in Europe, but it devastated the poultry industry in Taiwan. And and about the same time, it showed up in Canada. That was another combination. There was H5N8, there was H5N1, and there was H5N2. And in that case, all of the ends were not Asian, or at least the N1 and N2 were from North America.
Right.
And even the H5N8 had some North American sequences. And so that was a virus that all of them had a Fujian H5, but the they could be distinguished based upon both the and as well as several of the internal genes were also from North America. And that happened several years ago, and those were, kind of the most obvious indications that these all had wild bird origins, and in fact they were kind of stamped with the country, or at least continent of origin, based upon which genes it had picked up. When it started with 8 Asian genes, and then came to North America and picked up a bunch of North American genes. And so it's real easy if you look at the sequences, because this virus is segmented, and so you can basically look at the sequence of each of the 18 segments and see which one came from which. And this type of analysis is very, very easy. As soon as you have the sequence, you just put it up against a database, and the best matches come out first. And flu viruses are kind of named based upon what species they came from, as well as what location they came from, and when they were isolated. And so you can just look at the names of the viruses and see that, all of a sudden 3 of these internal genes all came from somewhere in North America, and mm-hmm. the other 5 genes all came from somewhere in Asia. And so it's very easy to do this type of analysis and see the virus without even looking real hard at the sequence. It's just, you can just look at the name of it. And that provides very compelling evidence that these all get spread by the wild birds. And what's remarkable is that, I just saw an article last week in ProMed, and it was quite a long commentary on the new strain showing up and trying to raise doubts once again that these were not due to wild bird spread, and this kind of propaganda machine, which is about all that you can say about it. It really has no basis in fact. It has been in operation since, it really geared up in 2005 when the H5N1, which was widespread in China and adjacent countries, one version of it, Clay 2.2, flew into Qinghai Lake in central China, and that right. gave rise to the Qinghai strain, which then spread to, initially it went to Russia and Kazakhstan and Mongolia for the summer, where these birds flew for mating season, and the locations are where these flyways cross, and they have all this mixing with other birds that fly in from other locations. And then in the fall, they all start heading south, and some of them go south by heading west to Europe, and others mm-hmm. go south by heading east to South Korea. And again, the stories of the sequence back then, all the viruses that had flown out of Asia were the H5N1 Qinghai strain. And once it got to the Middle East, it started causing human cases. And that started in Turkey, if you recall. And then it was in Iraq, and it was in Egypt, and it was in Azerbaijan. And these human cases got a lot of attention, and there were some changes in the receptor binding domain that made them more easily transmitted to humans. And they had other changes in the PD2 that allowed them to grow at a mammalian temperature as opposed to an avian temperature.
Didn't we dodge a bullet there, Henry? I mean, if that receptor binding...
Oh, we dodged a big bullet. Yeah. I mean, it's not really clear why there weren't more cases, but there were clusters of cases, and especially in Turkey, just about every report was of at least two. They were really in pairs. That when cases were reported, they were it wasn't a single case, and things were so bad that. The WHO withheld all the descriptions of the cases. They used to give, age and gender, and they wouldn't even do that. And it took a lot of work just to realize that every time they reported a case, there was a contact that was also infected. And that just got all bungled as far as getting information. From the human cases, the numbers were relatively high. That were identified. They weren't astronomical. I think they were in the 20s or 30s or so, and they were identified with local labs. And at the time, it was a major crisis. And WHO said that these are labs that they have experience with, mm-hmm. and that they believe their results. And then, but they wouldn't publish the results. They wouldn't say exactly who was infected. And there were some big families, and there were family members that were symptomatic, and they were hospitalized, but they weren't tested, and they weren't confirmed. And then it got to the point where they said, well, they don't believe any of the local labs. If they have to be confirmed by Weybridge in England. And then they ended up sending samples, and the first few were confirmed. And if you recall, I had made a prediction for this change at position 227 that with the Qinghai flying into the Middle East, there was H9N2, which when recombined with H5N1 would produce this receptor binding domain change. And they actually acknowledged that was present. But they withheld those sequences. And then in the end, all these samples went from Turkey to Weybridge, and they said, oh, they got degraded and they couldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And there actually were only four human sequences that came out of that whole event. And two of the four did have the S227N change that had to do with increased ability to transmit to the upper respiratory tract and in mammals. And then the same thing really happened in the other ones. The sequences out of Azerbaijan had other receptor binding domain changes. And the same thing happened in Iraq. And so there was a lot of sequence data that supported the fact that there were these adaptations, but it kind of didn't go a whole lot beyond. You know, these were first reported at the beginning of 2006,
right.
But it created quite a bit of concerns for those first several months, and then the virus did spread, and actually became endemic in Egypt, and so the Qinghai strain is actually still circulating to this day in Egypt, and still causing huge cases in Egypt. But that's one of the problems, and the reason I was raising the point of these new viruses. What happens is that they are spread by the wild birds. They go to these different locations, and some of the strains basically get established locally. There's still some H5N1 of a later version of Qinghai that got established. Actually, I take it back. It was an early version of Fujian. So Qinghai gave way to Fujian, and Fujian got established in Western Africa. So there's some early versions of Fujian in Western Africa, which were H5N1. There's a Qinghai strain in Egypt, which is H5N1. And then, you know, this event I was talking about with the H5N8, that gave rise last year to a huge outbreak of H5N8, and that spread down to Central Africa, and then it went all the way down to South Africa, and there's still H5N8 circulating in South Africa through the entire season, through the whole year of 2017, and now there's this new version coming in with H5N6, and the reason these are concerns is because you're getting all these diverse versions of the Fujian strain. This H5 Fujian did a lot of reassortment in Asia, and a lot of them stayed in China, but others kind of get into this path where they're in the wild birds, and they go up to Russia and Mongolia over the summer, and then in the winter they start heading south. And so that's what this initial report was, that this new H5N6, which first appeared at the end of the season in Europe, it probably went to Russia. Russia's yet to report the H5N6. It's not that uncommon. They end up reporting it late. That's what happened with the H5N8. These same groups that are in denial of the wild birds, you know, their concern is that, well, if wild birds are spreading it, they'll destroy, you know, humans will destroy all wild birds because they're the source of bird flu, of all things. Mm-hmm. And so to protect the wild birds, they're just in denial, and they, you know, came out with this wild birds as victims, indicating that the wild birds get affected by poultry, as along with the dead birds don't fly, then, you know, it can't be wild birds because they get affected by these viruses that kills them, and they can't spread it then. And both of those are, you know, patently false. And there's plenty of wild birds that can get a subclinical infection,
right,
and have no problem.
We have about 3 minutes left, just to let you know.
Okay, so just on the other topic, it turns out that the H7N9 that caused all the initial concerns in China was really a low-path H7N9. It had a couple changes that raised concerns. One was in the receptor binding domain at position 226, that it changed from avian to mammalian. The other was changes in the PB2, and there were some fairly large outbreaks of human cases of H7N9, which is pretty much confined to China. And then last season, at the end of 2016, beginning of 2017, this high-pass version emerged, and it wasn't really clear how much havoc that would cause. It seemed that the case fatality rate was high. It didn't have all these changes. It didn't have the receptor binding domain change, and it didn't have the PB2. But new sequences has indicated that more and more of them do have the mammalian PB2 change. Some have a mixture right now. Others do have the mammalian one. And they are now all over China. There's both human cases and bird cases. And so those are on the rise, and there's still the low path to circulating. So the H7N9, typically takes off the beginning of the year or so. And there's a concern that the new cases in China will include a high frequency of the high path as well as the low path. And virus that combines the worst of both strains could emerge. So you'd have high path that has receptor binding domain change as well as the PB2 change. And it could end up with a virus that's fairly easily transmitted and also has an even higher case fatality rate. It's already pretty high. It's already in around 30% or so, 30 to 40%. And so those were the two developments that I want to talk about tonight, that these were two big changes. They really both involve spread of these viruses that are more diverse, that are continue to evolve and have the potential to kind of break out and cause a lot more havoc than they have so far.
Well, Barry, you got it covered perfectly. And we informed people about flu shots and helped a lot of people understand what they were deciding on. So thank you for that. Very good. Very good.
Okay. Well, have a good holiday. And
you too,
see
Henry.
You next year.
Yeah, I'll
okay,
see you in care. 2018. Good night.
Right. Okay, goodbye.
Okay, there he goes. Hour number two coming up in just a few minutes. Hang on, and we will continue after this.